İlk konuşmacım Fazel Rana, Dr. Rana, Rhythm to Believe'in araştırma bölümü başkan yardımcısı olan, biyokimya dalında uzmanlığı bulunan Rana, biyokimya, genetik ve sentetik biyoloji alanlarında çalışmalar yapmış. Yaratılışın bilimsel delilleri konusunda iki kitabı bulunmakta. Birçok makalesi, belgeseli, podcast'ı bulunan Rana, çeşitli televizyon ve radyo röportajlarının yanı sıra 500'den fazla üniversitede, kuruluşta ve kilisede konuşmacı olmuş. Doktor Rana iki defa Doktor Klimter araştırma ödülüne layık ve Virginia Üniversitesi, Georgia Üniversitesi'nde hücre zarlarının yapısı konusunda doktora tezi hazırlamış. Yazdığı makaleler o kadar çok ki, Chemist, Applied, ABC, Journal of Microbiology, Methods and Journal of Chemical bilimsel dergilerde yayınlanmış. Tüm görürken evrim senaryolarının hayatın başlangıcını açıklayamayacağını ve hayatın bir yaratıcı tarafından var edilmiş olması gerektiğini anlayan Doktor Rana, kendisini bu gerçeği insanlara anlatmaya adamış. Doktor Rana bugün iki ayrı konuda konuşma yapacak. Birincisi, yaratıcının var olduğuna neden inanıyorum başlıklı konuşmasında biyokimya, hayatın kökeni ve sentetik biyoloji alanlarındaki son gelişmeler ışığında yaratılışın delillerini ve evrim teorisinin geçersizliğini anlatacak. Doktor Rana'nın ikinci konuşmasını da daha sonra açıklamak istiyorum. Peki, floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. I am truly honored to be here today. It really is a privilege to be part of this conference. We live in a world today where there's so much conflict that it's refreshing to be part of a project where the goal is to show the world that Christians and Muslims can work together towards a common goal, showing that there's scientific evidence for God's existence, and also showing that there's genuine scientific challenges to the evolutionary paradigm. Both are objectives that Muslims and Christians can agree upon. And the second point, that there are scientific challenges to the theory of evolution, is very important. Because if evolutionary mechanisms can explain the origin and the history and the design of life, then both believers and non-believers alike can rightly ask, what role then is there for a creator? In fact, evolutionary biologist and atheist Richard Dawkins says in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. And it's statements like these that cause many people to conclude around the world that conflict exists between science and religion, with science eventually winning the war. In August of 2015, the Pew Research Foundation in the United States published data showing that 75% of people who never attend church or seldom attend church think that there's conflict between science and religion. And you have to wonder if that perception of conflict is the reason why they refuse to entertain the possibility of God's existence. Tragically, 50% of people who attend church on a regular basis in the United States think there's conflict. This is a very sad state of affairs. And yet, it was science that brought me to the conviction that a creator must exist. When I entered college, I was an agnostic. I didn't know if God existed or not, and I honestly didn't care. I simply wasn't interested in religion as a young man. The focus of my attention was biochemistry. I wanted to do everything that I could to prepare myself to go to graduate school to earn a PhD in biochemistry. As an undergraduate student, I was convinced that evolutionary mechanisms could account for the origin, the history, and the design of biological systems. But my convictions were not based on a careful examination of the evidence, But instead, they were based on what my biology professors taught me. I admired my professors, and because I respected them, I accepted what they said about evolution uncritically. In many ways, my acceptance of the evolutionary paradigm fueled my agnosticism. When I speak on university campuses in the United States, I run into students who, like me, think that evolution is a fact, but it's not because they've examined the evidence, it's because their professors have taught them that very truth, or that claimed truth. When I went to graduate school, my views changed. You might say that biochemistry convinced me that God must exist. One of the primary goals of graduate education is to teach students to independently think through the scientific evidence and develop conclusions based on the evidence alone, regardless of what other scientists say. And because I was learning to think for myself, I was willing to ask questions that I did not ask as an undergraduate student. One of those questions was, how did life originate? The elegant design, sophistication, and ingenuity of biochemical systems prompted me to ask that question. I wanted to know, how does the scientific community account for the origin of such remarkable biochemical systems through strict mechanistic processes? After examining the various explanations available at the time, it was 30 years ago, I know I look much younger than that, but it was 30 years ago, I was shocked. The explanations presented by the scientific community seemed to me to be woefully inadequate. I was convinced that chemical and physical processes could not generate life. This realization, coupled with the elegant design of biochemical systems, forced me to the only conclusion possible, for intellectual reasons alone, that a creator must indeed exist and must have been responsible for bringing life into being. I reached that conclusion over 30 years ago. In the prevailing decades, the scientific evidence has continued to affirm my conclusion about God's existence. The case that can be made today for God's existence from biochemistry and the problems associated with the origin of life has even become more compelling than 30 years ago. And the goal of my lecture is to present to you the reasons why I think that God exists as a biochemist. And to summarize my argument, you just need to remember three words: fingerprints, failure, and fashion. A creator's fingerprints are evident in biochemical systems. All attempts to explain the origin of life, and hence the origin of biochemical systems through chemical evolution, have resulted in failure. And then finally, attempts to create or fashion life in the lab show powerfully that a creator must be responsible for the origin of life. Let's go ahead and take a look at the first point. A creator's fingerprints are evident in biochemical systems. As a biochemist, one of the things that I find absolutely remarkable is that the hallmark features of the cell's chemical systems are identical to those features that we would recognize as evidence for the work of a human designer. In other words, when human beings design, create, invent systems and objects and devices, those things that we make have certain properties that reflect the work of a mind. And it's provocative to think that those same features are defining biochemistry in its very essence. So if certain features reflect the work of a human mind and we see them in biochemical systems, is this not evidence that they too must be the work of a mind? Because of time constraints, I'm only going to focus on one of these features today, namely the fact that there are information systems found inside the cell. At their essence, biochemical systems are information systems. And there are two major classes of biomolecules that harbor information: nucleic acids, such as DNA and RNA, DNA is depicted on the left, and proteins. Both types of molecules are chain-like in nature. These molecules are formed when the cell's machinery links together smaller subunit molecules in a head-to-tail fashion to form molecular chains. In the case of DNA and RNA, the subunits are nucleotides, sometimes called genetic letters, abbreviated A, G, C, and T. In the case of proteins, the subunit molecules are amino acids. There are 20 amino acids that are encoded by the genetic code. Biochemists often think of the nucleotides used to build DNA and RNA and the amino acids used to build proteins as molecular alphabets. Just as alphabets are used to build words in the English language or in the Turkish language, amino acid sequences are used to construct biochemical words, proteins that carry out specific functions inside the cell. Nucleotide sequences are used to store information in DNA. In fact, the function of DNA is to store information that the cell's machinery will use to build proteins. And the regions of the DNA molecule that contain the information needed to build a single protein is called a gene. So the recognition that biochemical systems are information systems indicates that life must come from a mind. Why? Because whenever we encounter information, we recognize that there is a mind behind that information. When you receive a text message, when you receive an email, if you receive a letter in the mail, or you see a sign on the road, you immediately conclude that there is a mind that undergirds that information. So in like manner, when we see that biochemical systems harbor information, that is the first indication that these come from a mind. But the case for a creator doesn't rest solely on the existence of information in the cell. The argument is much more sophisticated. As it turns out, information theorists who've studied problems in molecular biology have come to the conclusion that the structure of the cell's information is identical to the structure of human language in its organization. It's not merely the presence of information, but the fact that that information is organized in the same way that we organize information. There is a language inside the cell. One of the most provocative insights I've ever learned relates to the structure and the function of biochemical information. In fact, this insight keeps me awake at night as I think through the implications. It turns out that the biochemical machinery that manipulates DNA is literally functioning like a computer system at its basic essence. And because this insight is so critical, I think, to the case for a creator, I'd like to spend a little time elaborating on this point. And to understand that, we need to think through the theoretical construct of a computer system. The theoretical basis for computer systems are abstract machines called Turing machines. These are not actual machines, but rather abstract entities that exist in the mind of the computer scientist. Turing machines are simple. They consist of three parts. The input, which is a string of data that goes into something called a finite control. And that finite control alters that string of data in a limited but prescribed manner, producing an output string of data. And this is a cartoon showing a hypothetical Turing machine. It turns out that you can link the output of one Turing machine to the input to another Turing machine. And in doing so, you can take rather simple machines and combine them to perform complex operations. As it turns out, this is precisely what happens when the cell's machinery manipulates DNA. For example, during the process of DNA replication, where the DNA, which harbors digital information, can be thought of as being the input, and the proteins or the enzymes that manipulate DNA during replication can be thought of as the finite controls. So here's a cartoon showing DNA replication, where again, the DNA represents the input and the output, and the enzymes that manipulate DNA are the finite controls. In other words, when the cell's machinery replicates DNA, it's as if a computer system is operating in the very interior of the cell. Because of the similarity between how computer systems function in processes like DNA replication, computer scientists have been inspired to develop a new technology called DNA computing. DNA computing essentially is based on DNA and the proteins that are found inside the cell that manipulate DNA. But these DNA computers are found inside little tiny test tubes that are this size. And these computers are more powerful than the most powerful silicon-based computer system that we have. They're more powerful than supercomputer systems. And the reason is because you can perform massive parallel operations simultaneously. The brainchild, DNA computing is the brainchild of a computer scientist by the name of Leonard Adleman, who's at the University of Southern California. And this is what Leonard Adleman says about DNA computing. The most important thing about DNA computing is that it shows that DNA molecules can do what we normally think only computers can do. This implies that computer science and biology are closely related, that living things can be thought of as computing something, and that sometimes we can understand living things better by looking at them as computers. Again, DNA computing highlights the remarkable similarities between human designs and the designs that we see inside the cell. And we can make advantage of these astounding similarities to construct a formal argument for God's existence by following in the footsteps of British natural theologian William Paley. In the late 1700s, Paley wrote a book called Natural Theology. In this work, Paley advanced one of the best-known arguments in the West for God's existence, the watchmaker argument. Paley reasoned this way: just as a watch requires a watchmaker, life requires a divine watchmaker. In Paley's day, a watch was the pinnacle of engineering achievement. Paley pointed out that a watch is a contrivance, a machine composed of a number of parts that interact precisely to accomplish a purpose. Paley contrasted the operation of a watch with a rock. Paley argued that a rock finds explanation through the outworkings of natural processes, but a watch requires a mind to explain its existence. Based on a survey of biological systems, Paley concluded that living systems have more in common with a watch than a rock. And if a watch requires a watchmaker to explain its existence, then by analogy, living systems require a mind to explain their existence. Advances in biochemistry allow us to bring the watchmaker argument up to date. We know from common experience that computer systems, the pinnacle of engineering achievements in our day, require a mind, in fact, many minds, to explain their existence. And because we find computer systems operating within the cell, we can reasonably conclude that life requires a divine mind to account for its existence. I find the watchmaker argument to be compelling. Yet in my experience, when I present this argument to skeptics, they will argue that evolutionary processes can serve as the watchmaker. In fact, they regard those processes as a blind watchmaker. This idea is articulated by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, where Darwin says this: Paley had the proper reverence for the complexity of the living world, and he saw that it demands a very special kind of explanation. The only thing he got wrong was the explanation itself. The true explanation had to wait for Charles Darwin. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is a blind watchmaker. And this brings me to the second point in my argument. Failure. All attempts to explain the origin of life and hence the origin of biochemical systems through chemical evolution or a blind watchmaker have resulted in failure. In order to appreciate this point, we must first have a very quick review of the way in which biochemists categorize biomolecules. We've talked about information-harboring molecules like DNA and proteins. But there's another class of molecules in the cell. These are small molecules that react with each other to form linear pathways and branch pathways and circular pathways. These are all interconnected with each other to form a vast network of chemical reactions in the cell. And these reactions harvest energy for the cell to use. They produce the cell's building blocks. These are referred to as intermediary metabolic pathways. And then finally, the third category are cell membranes. These are boundaries that separate the interior of the cell from the exterior environment. Or they separate compartments inside the cells. And each category of biomolecules has spawned different scenarios for the origin of life that are called replicator first scenarios, metabolism first scenarios, and membrane first scenarios. And according to the replicator first scenario, it was information-rich molecules like DNA and RNA and proteins that emerged first, and metabolism and membranes are secondary features. Metabolism first scenarios argue it was metabolism that emerged first, and then information-rich molecules and membranes as secondary features. And then finally, membrane-first scenarios argue it was cell membranes that appeared first. It's important to realize that each approach proposed by origin of life researchers suffers from intractable problems. For example, when it comes to replicator-first scenarios, the problems are legion. And I'm not going to discuss these problems this morning because of time constraints. My colleague, Anjanette Roberts, will talk a little bit about some of these problems with replicator-first scenarios. But I want to tell you a story that illustrates how significant the problem is. A number of years ago, I attended an Origin of Life conference in Oaxaca, Mexico. This conference was called ISIL 2002. This meeting attracted some of the best Origin of Life researchers around the world, and the opening lecture of that conference was delivered by a scientist by the name of Leslie Orgel. When he was alive, Orgel was considered the preeminent Origin of Life researcher in the world. And he was given the honor at this conference of presenting the opening lecture to the conference. And he was asked to summarize the status of the RNA world hypothesis, an idea that he was one of the originators of. Throughout his lecture, Orgel detailed problem after problem after problem with the RNA world scenario. And towards the end of his talk, he paused and he said, "I hope there are no creationists in the audience. But it would be a miracle if a strand of RNA ever appeared on the primitive earth." It's remarkable. Orgel was known as an outspoken atheist, yet in an honest moment, he had to acknowledge that the origin of life, at least from a replicator-first standpoint, appeared to be basically a miracle. Metabolism-first scenarios fare no better. Again, there are problem after problem after problem that we could identify with these scenarios. Because of time, I'm not going to go into them. But I'm just going to simply say this, that when Orgel was alive, one of the last scientific journal articles he wrote was a critical review of metabolism-first scenarios, where he said that these scenarios require an appeal to magic, a series of remarkable coincidences, a near miracle. And finally, when it comes to membrane-first scenarios, they too are riddled with problems. And some of those problems are listed on this slide. Again, I'm not going to go into the details because of time constraints, but a few years ago, a chemist by the name of Jackie Thomas and I published a paper in a journal called Origins of Life and Evolution of Biospheres. This is one of the world's leading origin of life research journals. We detailed the problems associated with membrane-first scenarios. This was a remarkable achievement because both Jackie Thomas and I are creationists, and yet the problems we identified with membrane-first scenarios are so significant, even evolutionary biologists had to acknowledge that our critique was legitimate. The editor-in-chief of the journal consented to publish our critical assessment of membrane-first scenarios in this premier Origin of Life research journal. In other words, every attempt to explain the origin of life has resulted in failure from an evolutionary standpoint. When it comes to the origin of life, you cannot say there is a blind watchmaker. When I present this evidence to origin of life researchers, they are very quick to agree that at this point in time, we have no explanation for the origin of life. But they argue that we still think that we might be able to explain chemical evolution someday because of successes that they claim to have in the laboratory, where they've been able to make, for example, building block materials through what are called prebiotic chemical experiments. Or they can make biopolymers or evolve RNA molecules in the lab or make self-replicating systems and manufacture protocells. And they point to this and they say, this demonstrates that chemical evolution could be conceivable. And this brings me to the third point of my argument, fashion. Attempts to create or fashion life in the lab make a very powerful case for a creator. When chemists go into the lab to perform prebiotic chemistry studies, they are working under highly controlled conditions. They carefully assemble the glassware. They fill the glassware with the appropriate solvents. They add the just right chemicals in the just right time and the just right concentrations. They control the temperature of the reaction. They control the pH of the reaction. They stop the reaction at the just right time. In other words, the chemists are contributing to the success of the prebiotic chemistry studies. It is highly questionable if these highly controlled conditions would have ever existed on the early Earth. While chemists may be present in the laboratory today, they were not present on the early Earth to oversee prebiotic chemistry. To put it another way, intelligent agency ensures the success of these prebiotic reactions in the lab. And let me illustrate this point by discussing the RNA world hypothesis. The centerpiece of this idea is the notion that the very first biochemistry was based on RNA. Later, the RNA world evolved to give rise to the DNA protein world that characterizes contemporary biochemistry. There are a number of lines of evidence that original life researchers like to point to in favor of the RNA world hypothesis. I'm only going to tell you one of those lines of evidence, and this has to do with the ability to make RNA on clay surfaces in the laboratory. In the mid-1990s, when this was accomplished, this was heralded as a huge breakthrough in favor of the RNA world hypothesis. But when you examine the details of the experiments, it very quickly becomes evident that intelligent agency was critical for this process to take place. Researchers, for example, have to operate under highly chemically pristine conditions. They have to exclude materials that would interfere with the production of RNA chains. They have to exclude materials that will cause the RNA molecules to break down once they form. These materials would have been present in abundance on the early Earth, but again, they're excluded from their experiments. They have to stop the reaction before the RNA chain gets too long, because if it gets too long, it becomes irreversibly attached to the clay surface. They also have to use what are called chemically activated nucleotides. These materials would never have existed on the early Earth, and if they did somehow, they would be so chemically reactive, they would react with everything in sight and would not be available to make RNA molecules. In addition, the clay that's used has to come from a specific supplier in the United States. That clay has to be treated in the just right way in the laboratory. If not, it could not be used as a catalyst for this reaction. This is what Paul Davies, an astrobiologist, has said about the RNA world hypothesis. As far as biochemists can see, it's a long and difficult road to produce efficient RNA replicators from scratch. This conclusion has to be that without a trained organic chemist on hand to supervise, nature would be struggling to make RNA from a dilute soup under any plausible prebiotic conditions. Evolutionary biologist Simon Conway Morris goes one step further. Many of the experiments designed to explain one or other step in the origin of life are either of tenuous relevance to any believable prebiotic setting or involve an experimental rig in which the hand of the researcher becomes, for all intents and purposes, the hand of God. This is ironic. The very experiments that these scientists perform to try to demonstrate the validity of chemical evolution and a blind watchmaker approach to the origin of life have unwittingly demonstrated that intelligent agency is the key ingredient in the transformation of non-living molecules to life. This conclusion, and I'm going to close in just a minute, this conclusion is further illustrated by work in synthetic biology. Synthetic biology is a relatively new area of biology where the goal is to create artificial life in the lab. And one of the goals is to make protocells, starting with simple chemicals and to try to make cellular entities. And it becomes readily apparent when you examine this work how important intelligent agency is. And let me illustrate this by talking about a study done a few years ago where researchers were trying to make an enzyme from scratch, unlike anything that existed in nature. An enzyme could be thought of just a small component in the overall machinery of the cell. It took a team of quantum chemists, computational chemists, protein engineers, biochemists, and molecular biologists to pull this off, and it required hundreds of hours of supercomputer time to model the chemistry. And they had to use structural motifs from biology to build the proteins. It required highly skilled scientists working in highly controlled conditions in the laboratory, utilizing sophisticated chemical instrumentation that itself was intelligently designed to pull this off. And what they made was laughable compared to what you see in nature. Although our results demonstrate that novel enzyme activity can be designed from scratch, they write, and indicate the catalytic strategies that are most accessible to nascent enzymes, there is still a significant gap between the activities of our design catalysts and those of naturally occurring enzymes. There is no blind watchmaker. And so when you look at these three facts, that when we examine biochemical systems, we see evidence for the work of a mind. We see a creator's fingerprints. When we can show that every attempt to explain the origin of life through chemical evolution has led to failure, and when we can show that attempts to create life in the lab unequivocally demonstrate the necessary role of intelligent agency, we're really left with one conclusion, that life itself must come from the work of a mind. And it's gratifying to me to think that 30 years later, the conclusions I came to as a young graduate student are valid. And if you are open-minded and you really follow the evidence where it leads, in my view, there's only one conclusion, and that is there has to be a creator. There has to be a creator that brought life into existence. And so the question then becomes for all of us, who is that creator? How do we relate to that creator? Which are far more important questions than whether or not a creator exists, in my opinion. Thank you so much.